with Leatrice Lee Caulfield on 5/30/1994. Leatrice, one of the fascinating things about our parents is that they did come from Korea. And could you tell me if your mother was a picture bride?
Yes, she was.
Before she came to Hawaii, please explain her education, her background, and as much of her life as you know before she came to marry your father.
Well, she was born in North Korea, and she was the youngest in a family of four or five. I know she has three brothers older than her, possibly another one, but I'm not sure whether it's three or four brothers. And she lost her mother when she was a youngster of about three, and was brought up by a stepmother and older brothers. As a girl, she was, she frequently mentioned that she was brought up without being discriminated against, because in those days in Korea, girls were lesser than boys. She was not mistreated by her mother, for instance, and she was given good care and loved by her brothers. And sent to school, I don't know what grade she graduated, but if she had enough education to teach. And there again, I don't know whether she taught in a kind of public school or the Seventh-day Adventist Church, of which she became a very devoted member in her later years.
When did she receive, at what age did she receive her marriage proposal from your father? Do you have knowledge of that?
I don't know exactly what age she received this proposal, but she came here and got married when she was 28. So I imagine maybe a year or two before that. And this marriage was arranged by my father's friends who lived, excuse me, I don't know exactly how or where these people lived when my father knew them. But I do know when we were old enough to know about these things, that they were living in Hilo, Hawaii. And I understand this couple introduced my father to my mother. One of them, Mr. or Mrs., knew my mother in Korea. How, I don't know again. So they introduced my father to my mother. They corresponded for a while, exchanged pictures, and then my mother came in 1915.
In 1914, after your mother came, and you are the firstborn, as time progressed, can you tell me from your observation and also from your knowledge, background of your father's education on his trade or how he learned his trade, and also what your observations are on his life at the plantation, I assume, plantation in Hilo?
As far as I know, he didn't live in Hilo. That's why I said I didn't know how he and this couple that lives in Hilo got acquainted. But he, I understand, came to Hawaii to work in the sugar plantations as a teenager, about 17, 18 years old. And there again, how he decided to come, I don't know. but I understand when he came, he worked on the island of Kauai. Because I vaguely recall, you know, the name of towns like Ele'ele, you know, Kauai. But when he came to Honolulu, again, I cannot recall. But somewhere along the line, he learned how to do tailoring. So he got out of the plantation employment and started working as a tailor. I remember as a young girl going to the first grade, he was already doing tailoring in Honolulu, Palama Settlement area, some place. I remember the shop there. However, he was not a good businessman, and the business didn't work out. So he gave it up, and then after that, he started to work on in the military establishments as a laundryman and tailor. These shops are usually combined, you know. You open a shop and you do laundry and you also do tailoring, making uniforms, military uniforms, and doing laundering of their uniforms. So, as nearly as I can recall, when I was in the second grade, I must have been about 7 years old then, we moved to Wahiawa, and my dad went to work in Schofield or Wheelfield, someplace. I don't know whether it was his own business or whether he worked for someone else again. So he worked there for a number of years, and about 5 years, I remember. Because I remember we moved back to Honolulu when I was in the seventh grade. I was in Waihewa from second through the sixth grade, so we lived there about 5 years. We moved back to Honolulu, and from then on, he worked at Potiruti, in the tailor and laundry shop. From, I can't recall the year anyway, since we moved out until the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, till the end of the war.
It's been said mm-hmm. that Waihewa had a very large enclave, the largest, mm-hmm. other than Honolulu, of Koreans.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you live in Waihewa?
When we first moved there, we lived way down near the cemetery. The place was undeveloped at that point. And there were strawberry patches all over. And we lived in a house. All I can say is it was close to the
cemetery.
Old cemetery.
Uh-huh. I know where area is.
Because I remember going to school, crossing the strawberry patches, and then walking all the way up to Waihewa Elementary School. And then my dad went to work someplace. I remember Wheelerfield more than Schofield, but I'm not sure exactly where he was.
One of the things about Waihewa, in addition to the fact that there was a large Korean enclave, is a large proportion of the trades happened to be the laundry and dry cleaning,
right. Uh-huh.
According
mm-hmm.
to a scholar, Korean-American scholar, Bernice mm-hmm. Kim. But during those years, Korea was occupied by the Japanese, and I was wondering, because your mother taught school in Korea, did she teach school in Mahiwa? Language school in Mahiwa?
Not as far as I can recall. She was just so tied up with the housework and bringing up children and struggling financially, you know. So I don't remember her teaching school at all, like your mother did, you know.
another factor that has always entered my mind about the Koreans in Wahiwa was their close ties to mm-hmm. one another. I believe they shared every joy and happiness, mm-hmm. every sorrow, sadness. From your observation, do you think your parents did keep you within the fold of the Korean community? Did they seem to just draw you in more so than allowing you the leeway of becoming assimilated? Or did they instill into you at that time sort of a way of life which will happen to be somewhat Korean or defined by them? And if so, what were these characteristics of a way of life which may be Korean? For instance, how you address the adults, certain times of the year there were celebrations, your role as eldest in the family. If these were values or even demands, how would you say these were characterized?
Well, as I recall, we were not discouraged from mixing with other ethnic groups, but because there were so many Koreans, we just naturally mixed and mingled more with them, particularly with your family, with the Chun family. My mother and Mrs. Chun were friends in Korea. And when my mother left Korea, I understand Mrs. Chun asked her to find a husband for her too, after my mother got settled in Hawaii. So about a year or two later, in the meantime, my mother found out about Mr. Chan, who was available and interested. So she introduced Mrs. Chan to Mr. Chan, and they corresponded, and later Mr. Chan came and they got married. Now, so we grew up very close to the Chans. We were like, we had no blood relatives here. Neither family had blood relatives. And not many Koreans here did, for that matter. There were a few families who had uncles and aunties, but we didn't. So we grew up like, we were blood relatives and consider ourselves cousins now with the Chun children. And so during holidays and special occasions we got together. And again, I don't remember the specific occasions, families were always there for each other at times of need and hard times and so forth. And then there was another family next door. When we lived at near the cemetery, the Kim family, Kim Myung-sik, the man's name, and the woman, he passed away, and the woman's name was that name just the tip of my tongue. Tammy Kim. They had several children, and we grew up very close. Again, we lived next door to each other. And so when one family was ill, like my mother was ill, then they would come over and help and bring food. And I remember there was a very serious flu epidemic one year when we were all tiny. Like I was about 7, 8 years old, and my younger brothers and sisters were small. The Kim family would make a pot of soup and bring it, leave it outside the door because they didn't want to catch the flu, and that's how we helped each other. And then later on, we moved to the upper part of Wahiawa to a larger home near the Chun family again. The Chuns had a nice home up there, and it was surrounded by a beautiful garden. And I remember going over there and running around the garden picking flowers. And then there was a mulberry bush outside the gardens, and that was my special joy. I used to love to go and pick mulberries, and bring them home and make jam. So I made jam. I learned how to make jam when I was about, I'd say about maybe 8, 9 years old. And even after, say some years later, we moved back to Honolulu, and I remember once in a while in the summertime going to Wahiawa to spend some time with the Chums. My mother would put me on a taxi and give me a few dollars spending money, and I would go to Wahiawa, and they would come and pick me up at the taxi stand. And then they put me on the taxi again when it was time to go home. That's how close we were.
So the importance of being close, remaining a clan, remaining family-like, mm-hmm. was very vital, because as you indicated, there were not many relatives and aunts and uncles mm-hmm. who had come by. Mm-hmm. I would like to have you explain the importance of education in your life and how this was shown as a very vital force, either through the influence of your parents or whether you were a self-motivator, and how you recognized that education was important to you.
Well, the importance of education was drilled into me mostly by my mother. She talked frequently about how important it was to get a good education and a good job. And in fact, she mentioned many times that when she came to Hawaii, her ultimate wish was to be able to go to school here and enhance her education. And of course, she was very disappointed because, children began arriving, and on the salary that my dad made, there was no way, she could go to school. much less feed the family, you know. It was a struggle just to make ends meet. And so in that respect, she was very disappointed all her life, and she mentioned that frequently throughout her life. She didn't accomplish that purpose, but she wanted us to get as much education as possible. And so did my dad. Now I don't remember my dad talking too much about what education he had in Korea. So I don't know. But I do know he must have had some, because he wrote well. And in fact, he was the neighborhood scribe. You know, most of the older Koreans, his generation, couldn't write. You know, they worked in the plantation, couldn't write. And they would come to him to write letters back to Korea for them. So he wrote our letters. Surprising that although my mother could read and write, my dad did the writing of the letters to Korea. And when the letters came to other families, for instance, they would bring the letters to my dad for him to interpret and reply back for them. And so I got this feeling of how important it was to go to school. And then, of course, later on, as I thought about how I was going to support myself, I thought, well, I had to go to school, but I didn't know what I wanted to become. You know, there were no role models to go by in those days. All the people I knew were, as far as the women were concerned, were pretty much housewives, you know. And they helped their husbands with the laundry or tailoring or whatever business the husband was in. But other than nursing or school teaching, I didn't know what else a woman would do. But I wasn't specially interested in these two fields. But I completed school anyway, thinking, well, I'll get into something. And I drifted into social work, actually. When I got out, I learned from some classmates that one or two of them had gone into social work and jobs were available. So that's how I started my social work field.
Mm-hmm. When you went to Columbia University, did you have to go on self-supported monies,
no,
or did you receive
a
scholarship?
I received a scholarship. In fact, I supported myself through school since I was age 14. When I was 13, I went to work in the pineapple cannery for the first time. And in those days, they needed workers very badly, so they didn't ask to see birth certificates. And I was as tall as I am now. So I got my, at age 13, and started on the night shift, working 12 hours in Dole Pineapple Cannery. And I came home the next day, and I cried and cried and cried because my legs were cramped from standing up for 12 hours. And for that year, that was it, one day, one night. But anyway, from age 14, I went back to the cannery, and then I worked there for several years again, every summer. And then when I was in college, I worked part-time through, there was a program there then to help college students. I think it was the WPA, or anyway, there was a special program in the schools in college we were allowed to work, I think, 20 hours a week in different jobs, and I worked under a professor working on some kind of a bibliography for him, for his research. And then after that, I would go to my father's shop in Port Dirusi and help with the servicing of clients there. And then at night, ever since I could remember, my dad would bring home uniforms that had been made during the day. And so my mother and I would sit and make buttonholes at night and stitch buttons on so he could take them back, take the shirts and pants back the next day. So, but you know, the thing is, I didn't think anything about it because it was just expected of me and it had to be done. And so I went to school, did my part-time work, and then helped with all this sewing uniforms at night. And then at times I would even go down to the shop and help with the service.
Tell me about your cannery work. When you did begin, what your pay scale was, what conditions were like, what the atmosphere, the environment, and also your co-workers, how you managed to go through that summer year after year. Is it because you lived nearby at that time? Were you living nearby?
Well, we lived within walking distance. So I walked to work, and then we took our bentos for midnight supper. And primarily what I did was called the canning. I worked in the canning section, and as the pineapples came down, we belt, then we would clean the ends of the pineapple and just leave the center portion and the bruised sections to go down to be put in the cans. So you could work either in the beginning of the belt by cleaning the ends, or you could work, usually the beginners started there, then as you got better and knew how to be more selective with the pineapple, then you were moved down towards the center where the choice pieces came down and you picked them up in the cans. Then after couple of years, 2 or 3 years, I was promoted to what they call reliever. And the relievers wore a brown cap, and we helped, we took over when the workers went upstairs to the restroom. See, they had about 10 or 15 minutes break each night, and so we would take their places. So we had to be able to function any spot, do anything. Mm-hmm. And it was, sometimes it got very rough, just keeping awake, you know, about 2, 3 o'clock in the morning.
So you worked the night shift?
Night shift.
Did you work night shift because there was more money involved, or did you work night shift because that was the only slot available?
I don't remember. I think in the beginning it was because that was the only thing available. And then later on, possibly because it paid more, a little better, you know. And I remember working all week and we'd make $15. You know, 12 hours. And I think we worked 7 days a week too. And I remember getting about $15 and thinking that was, you know, terrific.
In those days, there was no discrimination whether or not it was a man worker or a female worker who was on the line doing this kind of canning process?
All women. On the canning line. There were men, but they handled the cans after they were packed. Then they would stack the cans on trays and take them to the sealing area where the cans would be sealed. So they were mostly women. The packers were women, the relievers and the foreladies were women.
The work experiences that you have had in order to obtain your degree certainly did thrust you into your main occupation for a long duration, which was social work.
Mm-hmm.
And the majority of your years were spent here in Hawaii.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what years were that?
Well, I worked from 1937 to 1942 in a private social work agency as an untrained social worker, and we handled cases involving your children who needed special services, you know, foster home care or adoption, something like that. Then I went away to school in 43 to get my professional training as a social worker.
And that was in New York?
That was in New York. New York School of Social Work became affiliated with Columbia University just before that. Few years before.
Mm-hmm.
Then after I went on a scholarship from the local Department of Social Service. I had worked for a year for them, and then the scholarship became available. So I went to New York School of Social Work, and with the help of a $1,500 a year scholarship, I stayed for a year and a half. And I had saved a little bit before that, and I was able to get through school without having to pinch too much. Of course, during those years, the war had broken out, you know, just prior to my leaving, and my dad's business was a little better. So he was able to send me some money from time to time, and to get through school without too much struggle financially.
As life went on with your, evidently your mother working side by side with your father,
mm-hmm.
and with girls, three girls in your family, do you think that your mother expected you to set an example for your siblings? And if so, how do you think you felt about your responsibilities there in setting the examples in education? Education and being number one in your first child status,
mm-hmm.
must have had some importance to you, I'm sure. Do you think that your parents had expectations of you because you were the eldest instead of a boy? And do you think that your role as they got older contributed towards their fulfillment of being Korean?
Well, my mother especially constantly reminded me or told me as I was growing up that in Korea, the children took care of their parents, and the old children took care of the younger siblings. And so I grew up feeling that it was my responsibility to take care of him. And when I started to work, you know, I gave my paycheck to my parents, even graduating from college, for maybe a good 2 or 3 years. Then they would give me an allowance. And although they were not just, you know, rigid about this, I could, you know, take whatever I needed to. That it was not until I went to work in Hilo for a year. In those days, the social workers were sent to the other islands to work, like the teachers were, because they were short of social workers interested in going to the rural areas. And so I worked 1 year from 1942 to 1943 in Hilo. It was then I had my paycheck to myself for the first time. And of course, business was better too because of the war and the parents. My parents didn't need my support anymore. Then in 43, I went away to school because I had the scholarship through the agency.
One of the fascinating things that's ongoing now is, and it's all over the United States because of the multicultural diversity considerations. For instance, the Native Americans have their own enclave, the perpetuation of the language, the many, many other groups here in Hawaii, the issue of sovereignty. As a Korean American, do you feel that your parents have instilled upon you the importance of that culture, of Korea, of Koreanness? So can you tell me how you feel about this and how you think it settles within you as a balanced person because you have assimilated into the American process already, whether or not the importance of being Korean is still part of you, and if so, how this is within you?
I don't feel that close to us so much now, but I remember in my younger years, possibly maybe high school, intermediate high school years, because my mother had, again, it was more my mother than my father. My father was at work most of the time, and my mother was the one who did most of the storytelling and the telling of the history of Korea, why she came, and the political things that were going on in Korea, her hatred for the Japanese for having taken over Korea. She instilled a very strong nationalistic sense in me, and I remember at one point I would go to the library to read up on Korean history, and I would write on the side, you know, the of the pages which I disagreed with. You know, I don't remember specifics again, but where I felt that the author was not telling the truth about Korean history, and especially about the way the Japanese took over Korea and were treating the Koreans, as I got it from my mother. I would scribble on the side of the margin of the pages, and, no, this is not so, this is not so.
Mm-hmm. In this day and age, they would call that defacing.
Yeah, private property. I'm going to turn the tape mm-hmm. over right now because I think we're at a very interesting point in our discussion. So we're going to turn the tape over. One moment. This is a continuation of the interview with Leatrice Lee Cofield. You were saying about your mother's anti-Japanese sentiments. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me how they were shown and in what way they were passed on to you?
As far as I can recall, they were more against the Japanese government, the military, about how they came to Korea, took over the country, and how they were cruel to the people, but I don't remember the specifics about that. However, as I mentioned before, she mentioned it frequently and strongly enough that I felt the way she did, to the extent that I would go to the library, as I said earlier, and in the Korean history books, where I disagreed with some of the statements made in the books, I would write in the margin that this is not so, this is not so, the Japanese did this and the Japanese did that, kind of thing, you know.
And that was based on what your mother told you?
What my mother told me. Yeah.
Do you recall some things that your mother said that were in the history books that you did write down wasn't so? For instance, you don't recall?
I don't recall the specifics at all. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Did your parents participate or did your mother participate more than your father in any political rallies or in donating any monies to any political causes?
Well, they both participated in political causes. Now, my dad went more to the what they call the Kumminher, I think. And they contributed money as necessary. Again, specifics I don't recall. But I recall more my mother's activities with the ladies' group. There was a ladies' group, and I don't remember the name, but they met regularly, and they were very active. They talked political things, you know, about what was going on in Korea, and we collected money to help out. And also it seemed to serve, as I recall, kind of a support group for each other. You know, the members would tell each other their family problems, and they would be on the phone for hours and hours discussing their family problems and also what was going on in Korea. And I remember not being able to get through the line many times, and I would, you know, when I saw my mother, I finally got through, I said, "What were you talking about? That took so long." It literally went on for hours. But one thing I remember clearly, and that was that the group really was very supportive of each other, the members were, when they had crises in the families. You know, when there was a serious illness or death, they all came together, and we didn't have to ask anybody, we just came. And there was a wedding, for instance, they would all come up with their chopping boards and knives. Each woman would come up knowing that there was going to be food to be prepared. They would come, bring their own chopping knife and board, and stay the night, overnight. You know, they would make chon and namul and kimchi and this and that. You know. And that's how they would manage to handle a big affair, you know, with a minimum amount of money. You know, it was, they would just buy the food, and then people would come and help fix everything.
Those characteristics, I feel, define what has been stated as a clan, the clannishness mm-hmm, of mm-hmm. the Koreans here. Clan in the sense that it's like a family.
Mm-hmm.
There were no needs for questions in times, as you say, in crisis.
And no need to call people and say, can you come up and help us, you know, for this occasion or that occasion. They just came. When there was a death in the family, they would just come and spend the night, you know, consoling the family and help prepare refreshments. And
it's been said that Koreans here had a way of raising their own money in order to start businesses. And it was called either a taramoshi in Japanese mm-hmm. Or ki mm-hmm. in Korean.
Mm-hmm.
Did your parents participate in that kind of personal banking system?
Mm-hmm. They did. They would join a group. They would be invited to join a group and say, well, maybe they were going to contribute $10 a month or $20 a month, or whatever. There would be 15 or 20 members. So they would join, then go to these meetings every month and bring back the interest. Whoever wanted to borrow the money for the month would bid. So if, let's say, you were paying $10 a month among 20 people, that would be $200. And let's say two or three people wanted to use the money for the month, they would put in a bid in writing. They'd pay $1 interest or $2 interest or whatever. Then the highest got to take the sum minus the interest to each person.
Sounded kind of competitive to me.
Yeah. So that's how they managed many of their big needs. You know, that was their way of borrowing and handling, buying a big piece of furniture or paying a bill, a big bill, or down payment on a house in those days, for instance, you know.
Mm-hmm. Or a car.
Or a car, right.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of certain kinds of ways in which Korean things or even Asian things mm-hmm. were perpetuated here in America, I was wondering whether or not your mother had any other areas in which she perpetuated, such as herbal medicines or dress, whether she became Americanized and wore American dresses, and if she began to become more Americanized, and if so, how did it show up?
I think she became Americanized through her, as shown in her dressing, for instance. I don't remember again exactly when she began to wear Western clothes, but she, at some point, I remember she would wear the Korean outfits just for special occasions, you know, then it was all American. And
she never Americanized in her hair or makeup.
No. She never wore makeup, never took a permanent, never had a haircut.
Never cut her hair. Did she have any superstitions about losing her hair or her fingernails? And some Asians would not have any parts of their bodies just discarded into the
hall. As far as using herbal medicine, she did some of that, because I remember as a child sometimes being given Korean medicine to take.
Do you know what the medicine was?
I don't know what they are. Some of it was that ginseng, some, they would call it some, more or less for tonic purposes, to get you strong after a cold or something like that. But,
do you have specific remembrances about holidays that are very endearing to you? For instance, Christmas and what your parents would do over special holidays or special occasions in your family that are marked with perhaps special foods?
I remember New Year's Eve more. I think New Year's meant more to my mother's generation than Christmas or Thanksgiving, which, you know, were Western holidays more. On New Year's Eve, no matter how poor we were or whether or not we had anything to eat the rest of the week, somehow they managed to get some special foods and stay up all night cooking Korean delicacies. And then there was this elderly Korean couple that were sort of our surrogate grandparents. At some point, my parents had befriended this elderly couple that had no children. And they kind of took each other as parent and grandparent. So my parents would have them over during the holidays, during the New Year's holidays. And the couple would come over and bring food, like they would buy some meat and fish or chicken, and come and throw it in with our whatever we had. And they would stay up all night with our parents and cook. There was also an older gentleman, an unmarried gentleman who was my parents' friends, and he was kind of like a grandfather, and he came around just at special times of the year, and he would bring again food during the New Year's, especially Christmas, and again throw it in the pot, and you know, the ladies would cook, but he would bring a chicken or some fish, you know, some meat. And I guess that's how we managed the food part, you know, by contributions from different people. And we looked forward to these people during the holidays, during the New Year's especially. And New Year's, although we went out as we got older, we went out, but we were all expected to call in at midnight to say Happy New Year to our parents. And somehow we always did that. We remembered on New Year's Eve, no matter where we were, we called home to say Happy New Year to our parents.
Did you do this even when you were in New York?
No, no. Cost too much.
That's right. There were costs to consider. And also it was during the war, so there may have been restrictions on telephone. One of the things I'd like to ask you is, have your parents gone back to Korea?
My mother did in 19... I don't remember the year, but she was 70 years old, I remember. And both of my parents had never been back to Korea once they left. But around that time, my mother especially, began asking more and more about us helping to, you know, finance a trip back to Korea for her. And you know, the one funny thing I've never forgotten was, at that time, at age 70, she never used cosmetics, never curled her hair, anything, but she was vain enough that she wanted a brown spot on her face removed.
by a dermatologist. So we had to send her to a dermatologist to have one of these brown spots removed. And he, I think, froze it or did something to it, and she went to Korea without that brown spot on her face. And she had not seen her family in 50 years, you see, at that time. So, of course, in that period, the war had broken up, broken out, and we, North and South Korea, became separated, and we lost contact with our relatives in North Korea, where my mother came from. So since that time, we have no idea what's happened to my mother's three brothers in Korea, and all the relatives, cousins we had there. And my mother's older brother, who became a doctor, somehow had moved to South Korea. So my mother went back, looked him up, and in fact she had established contact before she went. So the important thing to her, and I guess this is Korean tradition, is that she made sure when she went back to Korea that her brother had a suitable burial plot. So she scraped some more money off of us to go back to Korea, when she's in Korea, to buy a plot for my uncle, oldest uncle. And so she was very satisfied when she came back. She had pictures of the plot that she had purchased for him. And she felt that she had done her duty to her older brother. You know. And it was very important for the old folks to know where they were going to be buried.
So. And I think, too, it may be part of their tradition of filial piety,
right,
of eldest son,
mm-hmm.
and the tradition being continued on, and also perhaps that's, you know, where life begins. Life begins at death, so that you would know where that mm-hmm. spot is.
Mm-hmm.
And it is there within contact, and I find that to be absolutely beautiful that your mother would consider
that. Oh, that was
that
the foremost
so
thing,
important.
You know, about her trip to Korea, that she be able to buy and know where her brother was going to be buried. You know. Being an older brother, you know, he passed away, of course, after some years after she came back. But she knew where he was buried.
I would like to know, what event in your life you would consider the most important, that event which has impacted you greatly, and if you're able to elaborate about it.
I guess my going away to graduate school probably would be the one thing I can recall that has made an impact on me. For one thing, it was about the first time, except for the year that I lived in Hilo, that I was away from home. And what a feeling of exhilaration it was to be completely on my own and away from my parents and able to manage. You know, in those days you stayed home until you got married, and going all the way to New York and seeing all the things that were out there, the
cultural, art, music, so forth, besides the educational facilities there. And all the people that one met there. And since that time, I guess I have, I felt that, well, professionally, of course, it meant that it made it more possible for me to advance. And as I look back now, I feel that the experiences there, exposure to culture, the arts, and so forth, have impacted me more than anything else I can think of.
I think that's magnificent. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that there are any other pertinent bits of information that you would like to say about your parents before we close this interview that are important to their history?
Well, one little thing I suddenly thought about was in talking about our parents and how they managed and how I was did things without thinking about whether or not it was an imposure on me, was the fact that you know, this business of helping each other, our parents helping other people, other friends, and I expected to help my parents, help their parents, and help their friends if there was need. For instance, while I was going to, I think this was my college years, as I mentioned before, I had a part-time job, and then I went down to the shop to help when I could. Then I remember once a month, the people doing laundry and tailoring in the military establishments had to send in their monthly statements for collection, you see. So the last day of the month, a written statement of who owed how much had to be prepared, and this given to the person in charge of the military who collected the what was
owed. I believe it was a post exchange then, wasn't it?
We gave it to the captain or somebody, whoever was in charge of that particular unit.
And this was at Fort DeRussy.
Fort DeRussy. Then they would collect from each enlisted man and then pay my father, you see. But you see, what happened was, this came the end of the month, regardless of what I had the next day in school, exams or whatever, I felt, well, it had to be done, and so I had to stay up all night, do my homework, and then prepare that statement. But the thing that I remember now, how I did it, I don't know, but there was another friend of my father who had a shop at another place. I think this man had a shop at Fort Ruger. My father was at Ducey. And he couldn't read or write. And he had nobody to make his monthly statements, and we lived a few doors away. So I was expected to do it, and I just did it without any questions. So I would stay up all night to do ours, then after my dad's was done, then I would do his. And I did that for years. Now, as I think back now, I don't know how I did it. But because I expected to do it, it didn't seem to be a burden at that time. You know, I just did it.
One thing I'm finding very revealing mm-hmm. here is that you're the eldest, mm-hmm. but you're a girl.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, there seems to be or an implied situation where there were expectations of you from your parents.
Mm-hmm.
that would have been equal to a firstborn son.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I find this to be absolutely incredible because they actually expected you mm-hmm. to take care of them because
they
of
did.
The way your parent, your mother had stated yeah. this in repetition.
Mm-hmm. However, it, as I recall, there was no pressure. There was no pressure for me to do it. You know, you have to do it. And I guess it was no pressure felt on my part because I expected it had to be done. For instance, with my father's friend, well, he was my father's friend and he needed this done, and so there was nobody else to do it, and so I did it.
Yeah. Well, I certainly thank you for the interview. I find this absolutely fascinating. This ends the interview with Leatrice Lee Cofield.